to Too Much Scrolling for July 19th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we have gotten to the end of the 56 Sherlock Holmes short stories written by Arthur Conan Doyle. And today we are wrapping up the final collection, the Casebook of Sherlock Holmes, which was published in 1927. This has been quite a ride, my friends.
Well, COVID-19 seems to bring the world together, Steve.
I thought that was Coke. Oh, sorry. I'm still thinking of Sherlock Holmes, aren't I?
Well, when I say bring the world together, I mean social distancing together.
Separating the world to bring us together. It's amazing how much the separation has brought us together, isn't it?
So the book was published in 1927, and something that we should probably note is that Doyle passed away on July 7th, 1930. So 3 years after the publication of the collection of his final group of short stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because this final group of short stories doesn't always get read, okay? So if COVID-19 had been a little bit more quickly dispensed with, we would have done what most people do, and we would have read the first three collections of short stories, maybe the fourth. Hardly anyone gets to this collection. And I have to say, I had read all of these stories before, but I didn't remember all of them. And I think I had only ever read them once, where I've read most of the Sherlock Holmes stories many times. I'm really glad we went all the way through the canon, but it's really easy and honest to say that this is the weakest of the collections. Right? I mean,
yeah.
It's controvertible, right?
Especially those first three.
We need to get real deep voice right now. We have to go like total late night radio. It's like this is deep cuts for Sherlock Holmes. And I think one of the reasons why most people may avoid this collection, along with it being weaker stories, is that it's still, for some areas of the world, it's under copyright. Which basically means that for a lot of our stories, we could just go out there and we could find publications on the internet. You could just pull it up and you could read along. For this one, it was a little more challenging to find where in the United States it's still under copyright, but in some parts of the world it's not. Sherlock Holmes is still in the news, and this collection is part of those news. So, you know, we just seem so timely with this, and that's because in September there's going to be a movie that's going to be released on Netflix that's going to be based on Nancy Springer's book about the younger sister of Sherlock Holmes. So the author's estate has been objecting to the way Holmes is portrayed in the series, arguing that the sleuth was only ever kind and emotional in the books that are still under the author's copyright. So that would be this casebook.
That's so funny. That is so funny. Do you remember The Adventure of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother? This was a Marty Feldman, Madeline Kahn, Gene Wilder, Dom DeLuise comedy from the 70s. 1975, to be precise.
Something tells me that it's been lost to memory for many reasons.
Yeah, it wasn't very good, being the main reason.
Now, I'm really fascinated by this claim that Holmes's kindness and emotional nature is only present in the later novels, in the later texts. Now, I do think that one of the things we've seen as we've worked through the casebook is quite a bit of evidence for the John Locke shipping that was really, really hard to find in the early stories. But at the same time, I do think that once you read the later Sherlock Holmes and you go back and look at the earlier, you do see glimmers of kindness. I mean, we saw that quite a lot as we went through because we were reading so closely. So it's not necessarily the most prominent feature of those early stories, but we do see that Holmes is a decent person, tries to do the right thing, and has a certain level of kindness. I mean, I think that you could argue that the BBC's Sherlock, by articulating Holmes as a high-functioning sociopath, is equally untrue to these books. I mean, I think it's just crazy when you have such a complex character as Holmes, who cuts across 60 original stories, but then also thousands of fan-inspired stories. It's crazy to say this is the real Sherlock Holmes. There's no such thing.
And the author obviously has matured quite a bit from when he was originally writing these short stories to, you know, the later stories that were written in the 20s. In fact, I'm going to go back to the argument that I think the attorneys are making, is when Conan Doyle came back to Holmes in the copyrighted stories between 1923 and 1927, it was no longer enough for Holmes to be a character that was most brilliant, rational, and analytical mind. Holmes needed to be human. The character needed to develop a human connection and empathy. I guess that's the argument they're making. And I think it's fair to say that after reviewing the entire body of work, you could see glimmers of this, just like you said, from the past. From the past and sort of, you know, holding hands while they watched a murder being taken place. I mean, that's like a pretty touching moment right there.
That'll bring you close to your best friend.
And I learned a French phrase during when I was reading about this too.
Ah, mon Dieu.
That's right. And, you know, I can say c'est une affaire, but that certainly doesn't sound like the French that that somebody I know would say.
You've seen an affair? What are you talking about?
C'est une affaire. Mm-hmm.
Une scène affaire.
Santa Fe. It's an obligatory scene. Basically, it's a plot element. It's a trope, especially what it would say. That's probably even a better statement on how, after reviewing all these stories, we can almost pick the beats of the things that we want to touch to make sure it's a Sherlock Holmes story. And the U.S., it also refers to a principle of copyright law, which certain elements of a creative work are held to be not protected when they are mandated or customary in the genre. So there is a, when we've read all the stories, there certainly are tropes that we're following. And it'd be very difficult to extract what was from a later Doyle story, from an earlier Doyle story, now that we've read the entire body of work.
And certainly those tropes have been used in just about every detective fiction since these writings. And they are not necessarily only the property of Arthur Conan Doyle's estate, but I can see how they would want to prevent this character's name from being used in a work that they didn't feel was fitting to the original work.
This part that was being argued is pretty funny. His closest companion, Watson, revered Holmes and was generous in his admiration. But to Holmes, Watson was utilitarian. To be employed when useful, then set aside, Holmes did not treat Watson with warmth. Holmes told him, "You have a grand gift for silence, Watson. It makes you quite invaluable as a companion." That was from The Man with the Twisted Lip. And Holmes did not even congratulate Watson when Watson told Holmes that he was going to marry Holmes' client, Mary Mortson.
Wow. I have so many questions about that characterization. Because for starters, Holmes said, "Watson, I cannot congratulate you. I think Mary's a lovely girl, but I will miss you." That's not the same as congratulating someone. Done with total warmth. Right. Much more often than "you have a grand gift for silence, Watson," Holmes is like, "I love talking things over with you because you have this amazing ability to not see what's right in front of your face, and I can work off of that."
That's way ruder. That is way ruder.
He treated him with tons of warmth. He said multiple times, "Watson, your ability to see nothing is what makes me see everything. You're a wonderful companion."
All I'm going to say is that there's got to be a good fan fiction with Watson going to therapy sessions and just unloading on, like, "Listen, I just need to know how to process this. I'm dismissed all the time. I'm told I'm a piece of furniture and that I miss every clue. And yet I'm still here."
It goes back to storytelling, and a great story needs a great foil. And Watson is a great foil, made even better by the fact that he is the narrator, that we get these stories from that foil's point of view is pretty perfect in its construction of these stories. Yes, he misses the things that we miss because he is the stand-in for us. This works so well.
Well, there you go. So the casebook is important. We have a movie coming out in September, and for all of our listeners who've joined us along the way, you're totally prepared now.
And we will totally have Pam on the regular Tuesday show to discuss it when it comes out.
Yes, please.
So we have completed our journey through the casebook. Some of the stories that most people skip, so these stories that are you know, second or third to the other stories. But we still need to pick our favorites from this collection. So let's start at the top. Pam, what is your favorite of the casebook of Sherlock Holmes?
Okay, so, you know, confession, The Adventure of the Three Garadebs. I don't think it's the best story ever written by any means, but I thought that it had the payoff for the entire series of short stories that really makes the John Locke fandom, which is an enormous fandom, and one that I think is super powerful in the celebration of a homoerotic relationship between these two Victorian gentlemen, which I think is a really important way to think about the 19th century and to think about like alternate sexualities as a powerful space. Because Holmes is super brilliant, and together they actually shape a lot of the politics of Europe in this fictional world. I love the moment from The Three Garadebs that we've been working up to all through the canon. Now, this story has an American element, and I have to say that as a Canadian who has for my entire life been caught between two cultures, that of Britain and that of the United States, I love Doyle's representations of America. And so all the way through, we've talked about this many times, but I think that there's something about, from my perspective as a Canadian, it's even more delightful to me than it sometimes is to you guys, that from this British perspective, we meet a senator from, oh, one of the Western states. Holmes says, this is a federal senator, right? That is like one of the 100 people who are making the big things for the whole country. And Holmes is like totally unimpressed. He's some senator from a Western state. Now, this is a funny story. It's got a throwback to the Red-Headed League, one of the most popular of all the Holmes stories, because it has such a funny plot where someone is trying to find someone whose last name is Garadeb, and that's practically impossible to do. And then we have our big payoff. So John gets shot. And I know we've read it on the show when we did it, but I'm going to read it again for our wrap up. Watson tells us, it was worth a wound. It was worth many wounds to know the depth of loyalty and love which lay beyond that cold mask. The clear, hard eyes were dimmed for a moment and the firm lips were shaking. For the one and only time, I caught a glimpse of a great heart as well as of a great brain. All my years of humble but single-minded service culminated in that moment of revelation. It's nothing, Holmes. It's a mere scratch. He had ripped up my trousers with his pocket knife. Okay, now, I'm sorry, but that is like my favorite. So Watson is really laying it all out there. These men love each other, and Holmes is, you know, Holmes has got the pocket knife out and is ripping off his clothes and he's trying to be a hero. It's just a scratch. So I love that scene. Three Garadebs, my choice for this collection.
Cue the love theme. Mm-hmm. By thunder. I said now.
Don't you dare make him a nice guy, because they will sue you if he's nice.
Oh, yes.
I agree with you. This is a good story. I like this story. It is the silliest of this collection, and you know how much I like the silly stories and the ones where you just shake your head and go, yeah, I don't think that that's plausible, Doyle. This finding this guy with this name, and no, that was never a thing. They just wanted to get him out of the house for an evening. Wasn't there an easier way to get this guy out of the house for an evening? Seriously.
You know those American senators.
Very silly.
And their schemes. Their schemes.
Very silly. How about you, Chip? What is your favorite of this collection?
Well, Steve, I chose the problem of Thor Bridge, because the Rainbow Bridge, you know, there's metaphors there. So why did I pick this, Steve? You probably want to know. Why did I pick this, Pam? It's because it has something to do with a chip. Thank you.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear. Wow.
Ladies and gentlemen, that at its best.
That is psychoanalysis in its best, too, because Chip found a story about him to be proud of. Holy cats. Wow. I thought you were going to say because Thor and how your love of mythology, because you really do enjoy studying mythology, and the fact that this bridge is named Thor certainly has something for you.
Well, there was a setup of an attempted murder, Steve. Or I'm sorry, there was a murder in this one.
There was a suicide.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
There was a dreadfully sad suicide.
Exactly. And I
there were children involved, and the nanny. My goodness, this was a very troubling story indeed. And
a suicide that was supposed to frame somebody else for a murder. So this is one of my least favorites because of the deep darkness that is in the heart of Doyle writing this.
Also, maybe there was no Steve in this story, so.
Exactly.
That's why I didn't like this one.
Didn't we have another senator in this one or something like that? Oh, it was crazy. Anyway, all I can say is that this was, there was a chip, and they had to find out the chip, and Sherlock Holmes knew exactly where it was, and the gun was at the bottom of the river underneath it, or the stream, or whatever it was.
Pam, I apologize for him and for bringing you into this conversation. We were talking about the upcoming Apple event that was coming up, and he goes, "Oh, good. Are they going to announce new chips?" I was like, "Good Lord, man."
Steve, let's set you up. Steve, save this program. Save us and tell us your favorite.
Well, I have to start with an opening statement, if I may, Your Honor. The casebook of Sherlock Holmes is not my favorite collection. Arthur Conan Doyle was good at pushing the buttons of his time, though, here. He was sparking conversations about some of the issues of the world, which many of them we still wrestle with today. Many of these stories involve alcoholism. A lot of domestic violence is presented as evil in these stories. There's a lot of sexism. There's a lot of women's rights issues that are brought up very specifically for the public to think about these issues. And there's a lot of racism. Now, to be fair, Doyle doesn't fight the racism element nearly as much as he does those other big issues of the day. It's not that I support fascism or any ism for that matter. Isms, in my opinion, are not good. A person should not believe in an ism. He should believe in himself. I quote John Lennon, "I don't believe in Beatles, I just believe in me." Not bad, but then again, he was the walrus. That's my opening statement, Your Honor.
All right.
Where does that come from, my dear?
That's Ferris Bueller. Welcome to the Chicago podcast you're a part of, Pam.
Isn't he a graduate of Shermer High School here in Illinois?
There is no Shermer in Illinois. Most of the messaging here from Doyle is about aging. We've talked about this over and over and over again. This is a man nearing the end of his life in his 60s. His late 60s, who is looking at his life and giving us these messages about what it's like to be old. The Three Gables, we get an old lady who gets a trip around the world, like a Price is Right style, of trip around the world. I like some of those elements, but the story that really brought me joy in this collection was the Sussex Vampire. This has the gothic elements that we've talked about, the mystery that was not easy to solve, but not impossible to solve. I think those are my favorite Doyle stories, when he honestly gives us all of the information that we need to play along, and we might be able to solve it alongside Watson, and maybe alongside Holmes.
I actually like Sussex Vampire a lot too. And one of the things I really liked about it was just the lovely, charming, humorous opening and closing of the letter saying, you know, oh, you know, we've been approached, says like a law firm or something, to look into this vampire, but the vampire is not our purview. So please, Mr. Sherlock Holmes. And when Holmes says to Watson, is the vampire in our purview? I mean, that just made me laugh so much, because we've got these epistemological conflicts, right, between the supernatural and the rational. And the idea that then at the end, Holmes sends back a letter and says, you know, in this very formal way, you know, dear sirs, you know, we have dealt with the issue of the vampire. Please have a great day. Sincerely yours. And so I loved that sort of frame. And this is a time where vampires are huge in popular culture. People love the vampire for representing many of the exact issues you just talked about. Anxieties about globalization, fear of the Eastern other, tons of things about sexism, but also sexuality. Real celebration of alternate sexualities, which is something that I really enjoy about the entire canon. So I like the Sussex Vampire a lot for some slightly different reasons than you, but very much in tandem.
Also, it was the first good one after those first three that were terrible.
Blah, 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 said the hunk.
I don't say blah, blah, blah. What else? What else? What else about this collection?
Save us, Pam.
I'm going to start.
Your only hope. Save us.
We're just going to do references to other pieces.
My second favorite story is The Case of the Illustrious Client. And this is one where we just get a lot of my favorite tropes from the whole canon. And so Sir James Damery arrives and he won't tell who the client is. And so Holmes is like, well, if you don't tell me, I won't do the case. But then he does get tempted into doing the case because it's about saving a damsel in distress. And I think there's actually rather a sensitive portrayal of this wonderful supervillain, Baron Gruner. And he's a guy who has like really good psychological insights into people. So when he seduces a woman, as he does very often, he tells her, ugh, you're gonna hear tons of terrible things about me. I've been totally, you know, painted in a terrible brush. This is what you're gonna hear, and this is the truth. And so he is out ahead of the rumors about him. And so when Watson and Holmes hear about a damsel in distress, they go out to meet her and they find that she's like a victim of this guy and that she doesn't believe, she doesn't understand she's in distress. And I think that's a really complicated and hard situation. And just as he deals a couple times with suicidal characters in this, I think there's a real sensitivity that is a 20th century sensitivity, not a 19th century one, to issues of mental health. And so I think this is quite good. Holmes gets attacked by Baron Gruner's henchmen and he pretends it's way worse than it is. And that's in the newspapers. And Watson threatens to beat up the guys who beat up Holmes. And Holmes is like, oh, my dear Watson, I love when you're so masculine.
What if you dukes? Come on here. Come on. Come on. Come on, man.
He's like, he's like, that's absolutely not what I want you to do, but I love that you thought of it. And then he tells Watson instead, and this is one of those outlandish things that I totally love. Holmes tells Watson, okay, here's what I need you to do. In the next 24 hours, I need you to become an expert on Chinese pottery. Is that cool? Done. I'm off to the library. And so he doesn't ask any questions. And that is fun because you guys, like, as a reader, you're like, what in the world is going on? But there's something so delightful about this is, you know, the older Holmes and Watson. Like, Watson's like, well, listen, who am I to question Holmes's judgment on this? If I need to become an expert on Chinese pottery, that's exactly what I'll do. And he sort of does. And then in the end, this was a callback to one of the favorite stories of all three of us, The Adventure of Charles Augustus Milverton, where just as Holmes and Watson are closing in on proving that Baron Gruner is in fact a supervillain, their proof isn't even needed because a victimized woman arrives and she takes control of the situation. Now, in this case, instead of murdering the bad guy in front of Watson and Holmes holding hands behind the curtain, this time she throws acid in his face, which is rather more disturbing in some ways. But it is that same thing where the damsel in distress is not, in fact, saved by the two middle-class, middle-aged white men. It's a woman who's like, you know what? This is it. This is enough. This guy victimizes women all the time. I'm standing up for my gender, for myself. I'm going to get even with him. And so, I don't know. There's something, this is kind of a great story in a lot of ways.
In many ways, he's a monster. I'm going to make him a monster. You know, when she threw acid on his face and he's like, no, I'll be back and I'll be even. See me in 12 months when I come back.
When I'm Two-Face, when I'm a Batman villain, absolutely. Yep. A lot of acid in Batman.
Tell us more about all that, right. Steve.
Well, this I do sort of agree with Pam on The Illustrious Client because this is definitely one of the more character-developed stories,
yes.
And you know how much I love character development in narrative, and we definitely get some really good characters in that one. The 24 hours to become an expert on Chinese pottery is just so silly that I can't not love it.
Right? Exactly. I think I'm in the exact same position. Yes.
So, Chip, what is your second favorite story of this collection?
Steve, my favorite collections always deal with stories where I can quickly make fun of them. And I got to have a lot of fun with this one because I said, this story is about a significantly older professor who is engaged to a much younger woman. The professor, seeking youth and vitality, is suspected of consuming a strange Chex elixir purported to turn back the effects of time. The side effects of consuming this virile tonic may be fits of rage. Can we think of a better reason to call in Sherlock and Watson to determine what's up? The professor's dilemma doesn't seem too hard. Yes.
You read that a second time.
God,
you're going to make me leave that in and not edit it out a second time.
God bless you.
Oh, Chip. I don't know why you like the creeping man story, Chip. could there be a more middle-aged story than this?
Something tells me there are a lot of Sunday advertisements during the golf tournaments to watch that probably have a lot to do with this one. I don't know why.
Christmas tree bark. So, oh my goodness, Chip. Wow. Here's the bad news, Chip. I totally agree with you. This is my second favorite story as well.
Well, that's bad news for me, is what we're saying.
Side effects? Well, could be.
However, the reasoning that I enjoy this one the second most is not the same as your reasoning. I think this is the most science fiction-y Sherlock Holmes story. This one, looking at the underbelly of the drug industry and how these promises of these medications to make your life better sometimes make you into a monster that crawls up the ivy, Dracula style. That's why I love this story, because I love science fiction, not for golf commercials.
Not for the golf commercials.
This is definitely the most science fiction-y of the entire canon.
Yeah. Until we get to the Lost World, right? That's not technically Sherlock Holmes.
Not even remotely Sherlock Holmes.
So, Pam, do we have anything else that we can reference that potentially could put some of these stories into the category of which are best and which ones we should discard if we had to?
My friends, I asked all my normal you know, my detective fiction listserv, some of my good friends, and I asked, like, hey, what's your favorite? And no one responded.
Because no one has read these. We are the only ones who have read these stories. Good for us.
Deep cuts.
So I should say that my good friend Susan Lyons from Maine said, Pam, I'm afraid I can't help here. I was put off in general by the stereotypes in the stories and what I saw as attempts to play to contemporaneous, particularly social science fads. What has rescued this section for me was what you and Chip and Steve have done with reframing these stories as attempts to experiment with narrative, as well as reflect anxieties, interests of this period. I'll certainly look forward to the too much scrolling discussion, though. So thank you, Susan, for staying with us through this difficult time.
Well, I was going to say, Susan has, this is the first miracle in her life. She needs one more to hit sainthood.
Thank you, Susan, for listening along. I hope we are providing you some joy in these stories that you hate so deeply.
Now, you guys, as you know, Arthur Conan Doyle made a list of 12 of his favorite short stories, and then he drew it up to 19 later in his life, but none of these stories is in his top 19.
Number 20, though. He had it right there.
Jessica Plummer at Book Riot. She did, I've mentioned, shout out to Jessica again. I've mentioned this before. She did what I thought was a great list of the 60 Sherlock Holmes stories in order. And guys, I kind of want to challenge us to do that.
Put all 60 of them into a ranking. Wow.
I'm just saying. It's a thought. Anyway, we'll reconsider that. But Jessica Plummer did, I was looking through her list to see which ones she liked. And I noticed that most of the casebook was in the bottom of the... And so I'll just read you. She's very funny. So she had number 60 of the 60 stories was The Adventure of the Three Gables. Deeply racist pass. Number 56, The Adventure of the Mazarin Stone. Extremely boring, also in third person for some reason, but losing Watson's narration drains all the life out of these stories.
True. Valid.
54. The Adventure of the Creeping Man. Not to spoil a 97-year-old story, but this one is about a guy who is injecting himself with extract of monkey to woo a much younger woman, which, okay. The weirdest part is when Holmes worries that this will lead to a nation of monkey extract addicts.
The problems have been around for years.
Man, you got more monkey extract.
Number 53, The Adventure of the Sussex Vampire. The later Holmes stories tend to be extremely implausible and silly, but this particular one is not improved by the addition of ethnic stereotypes and the inescapably murderous nature of a, checks notes, disabled child.
There is that. There is the problematic, yes. Yes. Go on.
Number 52, The Adventure of Shoscombe Old Place. The series sadly ends on a bit of a down note with a story that should be fun, drunken impersonations, midnight crypt desecrations, but is marred by sinister cross-dressing and some good old-fashioned anti-Semitism. two more to go.
Only three or four times during this.
Oh, so many times. So many times.
Number 50, The Adventure of the Blanched Soldier. Holmes narrates this one, and he flat out says that it's not going to be as good as when Watson does it. He's right. And then number 48, The Adventure of the Lion's Mane. The best of the Watson-less stories, if only because Holmes yells, "Behold!" and then kills a jellyfish with a rock.
Well, that will be, you know, going to the beach will now expand as we look for jellyfish with rocks in our hands.
Oh, my goodness.
So Jessica, I don't disagree Plummer with any of Jessica's notes on these stories.
I want to read her short stories because that is some great writing.
So great,
well,
right?
Done, absolutely. Jessica. So I hope that you are all still with us. I hope that you have been listening to our discussion of the casebook of Sherlock Holmes, and maybe, just maybe, it has enticed you to actually want to read it. that would be a great thing for you to do. This is not a bad collection. It's just not the best of what Doyle had to offer. So what are we going to read next, Pam?
Oh my goodness, I'm actually excited about this one. We are going to read the final novel. So this is the 60th work by Conan Doyle that we've read during COVID-19, and we are going to read The Valley of Fear. Now, this is one that I really like. I've published on this, and I often teach it in my American detective fiction class. So it does have an American element, and it draws together the classic drawing room style of Sherlock Holmes and also the hard-boiled American detective. So I think this one is way more fun to read along with. We'll do one chapter a day, so the chapters are really short, and I'm excited.
I'm excited, too, because we're going to get a... Hey, Chip, we're going to get learned by the professor on this one.
They're going to say
that we're... not going to happen.
Afterwards, we'll get a certificate. It just says, completed reading. Satisfactory.
Participant.
Satisfactory.
It's a green ribbon. It says participant. Good job.
That's the extra special thing that we bring to the table, Steve.
This has been so much fun. I hope everybody out there is having as much fun as we are. I hope you are ready for The Valley of Fear from 1915, jumping back in time just a little bit to the final Sherlock Holmes novel, our last group of conversations, two more weeks or so, and then we are done. We have read through every word of Sherlock Holmes from Arthur Conan Doyle. That's pretty amazing.
No more COVID-19.
And we'll get vaccinated as soon as we're done. So should be good.
And full credit, full college credit for this class. That's what I heard.
In our mind.
Mind credit. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Send us an email. Send us a voicemail. We would love to hear the sound of your voice. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of this fun discussion. And go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for all of these conversations all in one convenient package. Join us tomorrow as we get started on the final novel. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflo.
And I'm Pam Vidor. We'll see you in The Valley of Fear.